go.
I got juice!
When you've got just 28 minutes to save the entire planet.
The clock is ticking.
You better hope you got the right computer.
The best 30 plus minute alpha conversation you're going to hear all week long. I'm your host, Arifin Elijah. Join me today in honor of America's birthday. He's joining us in a very patriotic flag decorated Viking unitard, and you've never seen Old Glory look so good. Leander Caney is here.
Hey, Arifin.
I heard that outfit was barely legal.
I hate July 4th because every July 4th it's like, oh my god, you know, don't you really upset about, you know, this holiday? As a Brit,
that's funny, know. Because I think we had this conversation last year.
Yeah.
But I had completely forgotten. I was just going to ask you if you feel personally conflicted being half American, half British, yeah. How you feel on this holiday.
Well, I get
year.
My red coat out and I, you know, march around for a bit and try to round people up and
try to round them up. Hey, you! Who's this guy? Right. You have your white wig on, right? Just yeah. Powder all over it, all over your face.
Right.
You're poking him with your bayonet.
My musket,
to
them
out
yeah.
of the country.
Exactly. And I say, hey, Johnny Ho, what's going on, you colonialist? You awful colonialist. Why didn't you better get to work?
You know what? I love 4th of July. It's one of my favorite holidays. And everyone's making fun of Donald Trump for having the tanks roll through town. I want to be there for the tanks. Are you kidding me? What? What makes you feel more patriotic than a tank rolling down the street? Right. And of course, they point it up at the sky and it blasts, and you think they're about to knock down a building, but they've packed it with mortars, and these big explosions go off, and everyone's cheering. And then you know what they play in the background as everyone's shedding a tear over their full hearts?
That's exactly what it's going to be like, isn't it? USA! USA!
That's exactly how I feel every 4th of July. My heart is just full. I look at my flag at Old Glory hanging there blowing in the breeze, and I just think, oh, I love my country. I love 4th of July. You know what? It's so purely American. That song encapsulates everything that is American.
Well, he got the idea from the Bastille Day Parade, which we saw a few years ago when we were in Paris. Oh. And, you know, they
get all pretty crazy.
Well, you can't see a thing for a start, and because there's the huge crowds, and we're on the Champs-Élysées, and they do, you know, they have like all these different soldiers, all these different units. And the weird thing is that the French soldiers wear these really bizarre outfits. They look like clowns.
Huh.
They have these crazy hats, and they have like weird.
What's the holiday called again?
Bastille Day.
Oh, Bastille Day.
You know, and that's the sort of, you know, the French 4th of July.
Okay.
But all the soldiers are so funny. I mean, they really do look really, because they wear these weird ceremonial uniforms, and they look, some of them, I don't know, they do look medieval. They, or you know, 18th, 17th century.
Wow.
They really do look strange. And so you see these, and sometimes they have modern weapons as well, with these really weird old uniforms. You know how like the British Busbies, you know, those bizarre hats.
Yeah, I was just gonna say their hats do not look tough at all.
No.
Why is it? Why is it that these military outfits always end up looking preposterous and not tough in any way? Like, you look at this hat, well, there's a giant feather coming out of it. It's like a 12-inch feather coming out the top.
Exactly. Well, this is what the French parade is like. It was even crazier than, like, you know, gay pride here in San Francisco. It was like these really crazy outfits. They're all supposed to be soldiers. It's
is this
totally
the gay
fun.
Pride parade? You're like, oh, no, it's the French military.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I feel like American military uniforms don't have any of this frivolous ropes and ribbons and feathers all over the place. I mean, they have like little medallions and stuff, but they still look sleek and tough. They don't look like they're some college professors at graduation, right? Like those outfits that they wear at graduations,
right,
which
yeah.
I don't know how they ended up evolving into that ridiculous outfit, but it looks completely ridiculous. These people are supposed to be some of the smartest people in the country, and yet they dress themselves in these outfits on purpose.
Yeah, no, it looks like something from Hogwarts, doesn't it? They're Hogwarts, you know, Harry Potter refugees.
That's true. It does look like something out of a Harry Potter movie. That's so funny. Anyway, happy birthday, America. Happy birthday, everyone celebrating 4th of July. What other holiday is it perfectly legal and, in fact, encouraged to shoot your friends with a giant ball of fire and then laugh about it while you're drinking? You know, all of the days of the year, it's illegal to do that. But on 4th of July, it's almost mandatory to shoot your friends with a Roman candle,
well,
and then you guys can all have a chuckle
about
it
later. Launched out of your butt. Well,
I haven't tried that, but that's a great idea. See, you're bringing your British flair to the American holiday. We appreciate that.
Yeah,
we need those kinds of ideas. And tomorrow, well, we're filming this on the 3rd, but on 4th of July, America's going to be 243 years old. 243 years old. So practically as old as you, Leander.
Yeah, hilarious.
Okay. Well, we do have some Apple stuff to talk about this week. We got some stories here. Let me just tell you. We got to talk more about Johnny Ive because it right after we recorded last week, this report came out from the Wall Street Journal that gave us some more information. And I would say, from the way they framed it, the real reason Johnny Ive may have left Apple, and the real reason is a lot less benign than the reason that we had talked about on last week's show. In fact, it's kind of crazy, some of these details. So we'll go over this story. Leander has some thoughts to share. And then we're going to talk about Johnny Ive's fiddle factor, that special something that Johnny Ive brought to Apple that it seems like few designers possess, and now Apple is going to be missing as well. And hopefully they can make up for it in some other way. But Leander's going to tell us about Johnny Ive's fiddle factor. Before we dive in, let me go ahead and say thanks to Squarespace for supporting this episode. It's halfway through 2019. You've been procrastinating the whole year. You still don't have a website. You've started a business. Maybe you're trying to promote a certain skill set. Maybe you have a party coming up that you're trying to promote, a bat mitzvah, a bar mitzvah, a birthday party, a graduation celebration, something. There's so many reasons to have a website up, and it can be a huge pain in the ARSE to get a website up. Trust me, especially if you want it to look good on all the devices that visit your website. Squarespace makes it so easy to put a website up quickly, and your site's going to look beautiful. You just choose one of their templates. You can drag and drop images in, videos, your social media. You can customize it in a zillion different ways, and you don't have to know how to code. Everything is just drag and drop. Your website's going to be up in no time. It's going to be looking beautiful. You can select the color schemes, the fonts, everything you want. You'll actually have fun doing it. It's kind of fun to go in there and play around with everything. And you can spend a little time on it or a lot of time up on it. It's up to you. Boom, you'll have a website up and running. If you want, you can start a blog. You can sell products and services of all kinds. Now they have Apple Pay integrated in, so they're constantly adding new features and keeping your site current. And they also have amazing customer support. So if you get stuck, there's always someone there to help you get unstuck and get you moving again. And you can bring in contributors to help you if you want to have content from your friends and family for them to pitch in and take some of the workload off of you or your employees, of course. Check it out, squarespace.com/cultcast, squarespace.com/cultcast. Use code cultcast at checkout, and you will save 10% off your first order. But of course, you have a 2-week free trial to build a website and just see how you like it. Squarespace.com/cultcast. Okay, Leander, let's jump right into this big story. This week, this story from the Wall Street Journal that talks about the real reason that Johnny Ive left Apple, and it paints a bleak picture. They say, basically, the Wall Street Journal says that he's been drifting away from Apple for years, and it's due in no small part because they are increasingly not taking design seriously. Woo!
Whoa.
That's a zinger. That's like everyone's worst fear about
right.
Apple.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And that was one of our things that we were bouncing around previously as to why maybe he had left. Well, according to the story, that is one of the reasons why he left. Citing people close to Apple's leadership and conversations over more than a year with people who worked with Johnny Ive, the Wall Street Journal says around 2015, after the launch of the Apple Watch, Johnny became dispirited with Apple. He had envisioned the Apple Watch as a fashion accessory, but Apple execs saw the device as an extension of the iPhone. Ive also reportedly grew frustrated as Apple's board became increasingly populated by directors with backgrounds in finance and operations rather than technology or other areas of the company's core business. Quote, few on the outside knew that for years, Mr. Ive had been growing distant from Apple's leadership, say people close to the company. Mr. Jobs' protege and Apple's closest thing to a living embodiment of his spirit grew frustrated inside a more operations-focused company led by Chief Executive Tim Cook, y'all. Mr. Ive, 52, withdrew from routine management of Apple's elite design team, leaving it rudderless. This is all from the Wall Street Journal story, by the way. Increasingly inefficient and ultimately weakened by a string of departures, people close to the company say. So it's interesting, isn't it? Because we have been talking about why other people have been leaving Apple, and it seems like they are leaving in, I don't want to say in droves, because they haven't lost a lot of people, but what they've lost four people, including Ive, in the last year. Is that right, Leander?
I thought it was six.
Six people. Okay, so that's a lot of people.
And I think seven with Ive.
Wow, okay. let's see here. He started missing work and skipping meetings. At the industrial design team, Mr. Ive's absence was straining the cohesion central to product development. A key designer left in 2017, and others were considering leaving as well. In 2017, Tim Cook met with Johnny to discuss resuming day-to-day responsibilities, and Mr. Ive agreed. Initially, the design team was encouraged, but his absences were later resumed. He spent more time in the UK, where his father had been ill. We talked about that last week. And Tim Cook was not happy about the story, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But your thoughts, Leander, because I thought this was pretty damning of Apple and the philosophy that has been becoming more prominent at Apple as they move from a hardware company to a services company, right, to a design-focused company to operations-focused company. I don't know if that's true. What do you think?
Well, yeah, you know, I think it fits that narrative that a lot of people, that's been kind of, you know, prevalent about Apple the last couple of years, with Cook and sort of like some of his key people, you know, like some of the key replacements, like when Angela Arendt left, you know, he replaced her with Didier O'Brien, who of course comes from operations. And if you look at a lot of the COOs, I'm sorry, the C-level positions, you know, a lot of them are Apple operations people. And a couple of people pointed out on Twitter, you know, like, oh my God, look at this, you know, a lot of Apple senior leadership is coming from the ranks of operations. This is now an operations company. And you know, people's fears about the MacBook keyboards, for example, you know, it looked like, you know, there's something missing, you know, they're not paying attention, they're not on their game. So this story kind of fit that narrative, I think, you know, about Apple's recent problems. But I don't know, you know, I took it with a big sort of a little bit of a pinch of salt. Mm-hmm. There's obviously, you know, some of it is definitely true. I think the descriptions about what Johnny Ive's been up to, his dad's been sick, had a stroke, and so he's been spending more time back in the UK, flying back on his private jet, you know, to take care of his dad. And that's totally understandable, right? I think, you know, that might explain a few of the absences, rather than him being checked out. But then of course his quitting, you know, shows that, yeah, it's time for him to move on. You know, he wants to do something else. But I don't know, you know, we haven't heard from the principals. There's probably a kernel of truth there, but you know, without getting his word on what's going on, I think there's a big gap there, of course, right? You know, we don't have his explanation of what's going on, what's happening. The one thing that I find the most skeptical about is this, you know, this idea that the design doesn't matter anymore, and I think that's categorically not true. You know, I think that the culture of the company has been fundamentally altered by, you know, it has been altered. And of course that was, you know, what Johnny Ive and Steve Jobs did. That was their legacy at the company. You know, it took them 10 years. It used to be engineering driven. You know, the designers were given a box of parts of components and then told to slap a nice skin on it. Mm-hmm. And it took them, you know, a good 10 years of fighting that culture to make it the other way around, you know, to like to go. And in fact, it wasn't necessarily the look of it. It was the way it worked. You know, they would come back. They'd start with, how does this thing work? You know, what's the experience of using this product? And that's what the industrial designers, you know, worked on. And so then they would do things like, this is why computers like the Cube were so important, even though it was a failure. The Cube was one of the first computers ever that was designed from the outside in. You know, and mm-hmm. They learned a whole bunch of important lessons in it, and it kind of exemplified their approach to product development. You know, they came up with how they wanted this thing to look and to function on the outside. You know, and then they made the engineers cram all the components on the inside, and that was true. You know, I think of all the other products that followed that. You know, they were concerned primarily with the usage. You know, how did it work? How did it look? How would people, you know, interact with these devices? And I think that culture is well and truly embedded so deep into, you know, how Apple operates now, that I don't think even with Ive leaving that it's in danger. I think the designers, you know, the industrial design team are front and center. And in fact, you know, Ive has taken it one step further, where he's now integrated the software design teams with the hardware design teams. And they're now working together. Before, Jobs kept everything so siloed that the software people couldn't talk to the hardware people. Even at the highest level, you know, like the industrial designers, you know, they had no idea what Scott Forstall's team was working on when they come up with the iPhone interface. They had like they had a sticker of the home screen that showed some icons and some apps, and that was it. You know, like none of the industrial designers knew how this thing was going to work because Jobs wanted to keep everything siloed and secretive, and it was so unworkable that they would actually, you know, like Johnny Ive would sneak in the software designers into the lab. And they would show him what he's working on, and he would show them what they were working on. And in fact, one of them, Imran Chowdhury, in Fast Company today, was saying that they actually did it in the car park. The first look they got at each other's, the first look the hardware team got at the got a look at the software, what the software folks were working on, was in Apple's car park. They went outside and they opened up the trunk of a car, and they were hiding in the trunk of the car so that, you know, no one would see them. So they would perform these weird tricks, you know, like to go behind Steve Jobs' back, you know, because of his ethics. It just was kind of unworkable. Anyway, you know, Ive has, like, I think, you know, elevated design front and center to Apple. And the other point I wanted to make, sorry, I'm going on a bit, but it was about operations. You know, like they're saying that this operations driven and operations has taken over and operations is all important and that he's become dispirited because it's all about operations. And, you know, this has always been at the... Operations is always super important to design, industrial design. Industrial design, by its definition, is making stuff, you know, industrial products, stuff to be manufactured at mass scale. You know, he's not a carpenter, he's not a sculptor, he's not an artist, you know, he's not making one-offs. Everything that comes out of that studio is designed to be made in the millions in factories. So, and operations is there at the very beginning, you know, like operations is involved from the very, very get-go, you know, because they can't make these things without being concerned about how they're going to be made. So there's operations has always been a huge part of, you know, the design team's functioning and thinking. So I don't get it when they say, you know, that there's tension between operations. I mean, of course there's going to be tension because they can't always do everything they want. But and in the past, you know, I think, you know, the engineers would sometimes, this is where maybe there's a point, you know, in the past, sometimes engineers would say, you know, that's too expensive, we can't do that. And in the past, design would lose. But, you know, like Jobs was so design-centric that he would weigh in and he would, you know, decide arguments in design's favor. And I think the culture, you know, when I was doing the book on Johnny Ive, was definitely that the designers were, you know, they were the gods. You know, they were the ascendant. They were the most important people at the table. And anything they said, you know, had to be done. The operations people had to accommodate the designers. Maybe that balance of power has shifted a bit. It's, you know, there's definitely some rumblings about it, but I don't know if there's any, you know, concrete examples, and I don't know if that would cause him to quit, because I think he's always had this battle, you know, like he was battling this from the very get-go. There's always this tension. I think he's become, you know, like he obviously wants, I think he's had such an amazing career, he's done so, you know, I think there's very little left to prove, and you know, he wants to get into, I think, something that he can't do at Apple, which I guess it's like a wider breadth of products. You know, he wants to do, before he joined Apple, he was doing things like, you know,
Pens,
right? one of the most famous ones was bathroom accessories and stuff like that. But, you know, if you work for an agency, you can get, you know, you people commission you from all kinds of, and they're all, and you never really know what's going to be coming in, I guess. And now, of course, he's a celebrity designer, so he can charge gobs of money. He can work for whoever he chooses. And he's been working with, you know, Newsom for the last couple of years. I mean, they've done a few one-off projects. They did a camera for Leica. What else did they do? They did something else together, which I can't remember what it was. But, you know, like, he'd been working on Apple Park for a couple of years and in architecture, you know, so, and he was doing things like tables and all the different details and all the finishes in the Apple Park building. Maybe that, you know, maybe that was like he wants to do more of that. Maybe he wants to, like, you know, that's what I think, is that he wants to do different projects that he can't do, you know, by continuing to work at, you know, be Apple's main designer.
I hope you're right that Apple is not demoting the importance of design in any way. Have you ever heard the story of how Seinfeld and Larry David wrote Seinfeld and why that show was so successful.
Did you hear that story?
They basically sat in a room. Seinfeld said the magic was this. They sat in a room and they spent 98-99% of their time writing. That was the magic. They didn't leave the room. They didn't want any interruptions. They didn't go and participate in any of the business of Seinfeld or any of that other nonsense. Their job was to write a great episode, and that's what made it successful. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting parallel to what happens at Apple is the magic, the heart, the soul of what Apple does, why they are so successful, happens in that design studio. Those designers working together, collaborating, coming up with these great ideas, and Johnny Ive fostering an environment that allow these people to be their most creative selves and come up with ideas is why Apple is so successful. And that creativity, it's fragile. It's very easily stifled. And if you have some operations person in there saying, well, you can't do this because the engineer said it won't work, or this isn't going to work, or they don't take them as seriously as they may have otherwise in the past, which is, you know, what that culture that Steve Jobs built and that culture that Johnny Ive helped to endure while he was there, you're going to start losing talented people. And I start to see people leave and I start to say, oh, that's interesting. And then Johnny Ive's leaving and I think, oh, okay, this might be a bad sign. And then I see this story from the Wall Street Journal who has historically been somewhat accurate. Now, they may not have the full story, but still they're saying Apple's becoming more operations focused. And I think to myself, well, if you're a designer passionate about design and you start to see cracks in the foundation, you might think, hey, this might be a good time for me to leave and see what my other options are. And this could be bad news for Apple. So I hope that you're right. And this isn't a sign that Apple is moving away from the model they've been using, from keeping their designers on a pedestal, giving them ultimate power to direct the ship and moving it to some marketing department or some operations department that says, we need to sell what Samsung's selling because that's what sells these days. Quick, make me a 8-inch flablet and we're going to, you know, make sure that it has 15 cameras on the back and two styluses because that's what people want these days. Because then Apple is just going to become Samsung and it will be time for us to start up that Windows podcast. I already got Steve right. Ballmer on board. I emailed him and he said, he's all capital letters, I'm on board, just let me know when. So we'll have an all-star cast of people. We could talk about Windows 10, Windows 11 probably. And that could be fun, you know, as a backup plan. What do you think about that?
Terrible.
In fact, I see a new book on the horizon. Let's see here. Bill Gates. No, wait. Steve Ballmer. The genius that took Microsoft operating system to the next level.
No. It's going to be the new guy, you know, Nutella.
Oh, yeah. Nutella. Yeah, that's right.
There's definitely something. I mean, like that is a good point. I think, you know, like counter to what I was just saying, there's definitely something going on with the design team. Like, you know, the six people that had left, those guys had all been there since like the sort of mid-90s, the early 90s, the mid-90s. You know, the team that had been recruited by Ive, they were very close socially as well as professionally. You know, they all hung out together and it was like they were doing a lot of partying. And, you know, something's obviously, I think that old guard is checking out. But, you know, I think that so there's a bunch of new designers in there now, and maybe it's a good thing. You know, I'd heard some people saying that, you know, that maybe it's good to turn it over to a new generation, you know, of younger designers, as long as that culture holds. You know, as long as that culture that Ive and Jobs created of putting the designers front and center and having them to be the most important people in the room. You know, when they're making decisions. And of course, you know, I don't know, like a lot of people are fearful about that. And of course, the one thing they point out is the fact that that they've now split it up. There's two, the design is now being led by Evans Hanke, who leads the industrial design group and the hardware side. And, I've forgotten his name. What's the other guy's name? Oh my God, it was right on the tip of my tongue. The software, the human interface guy.
You put me on the spot now. I forgot it too.
Alan Dye. So Alan Dye, yeah. and then we're pointing at Jeff Williams, you know, of course, he's in operations, right? So everyone's, oh my God, operations taken over. But Williams's big product has been the Apple Watch. You know, he was the one who was sort of directly responsible for the Apple Watch. And, you know, it's not making as much money as the iPhone. It's not a huge hit as like the iPhone was, but I think it's turned into a very successful product. Yeah. It's a huge sleeper hit. It's like everything that Apple does well. It's a really beautiful integration of hardware and software. It's totally useful. It saved a whole bunch of people's lives. I use it all the time. It's extraordinarily capable. Some of the stuff it does is like just mind-boggling. That's sort of been run by Jeff Williams. So maybe Jeff Williams is the new sort of Johnny Ive.
Yeah, we touched on this last show too. I hope you're right. And of course, one of the reasons why this story is so salacious is because it confirms what so many people have been saying for such a long time. Apple seems to have lost it. They're not creating the products at the same level that they used to be creating. They're not taking it as seriously as they used to be taking it. And now you have this story from the Wall Street Journal that hits your reticular activating system. And you're like, uh-oh, right. Confirmed, yeah, right? Yeah. Confirmation bias. This is exactly the story I was waiting for. It's like, boom, Apple is doomed. See, I was right.
Right.
So it gets everyone talking about it.
Right,
but
yeah.
I think the truth is probably more in the middle. I think that maybe some of these design changes or some of these changes at Apple maybe got Johnny thinking about leaving, but clearly the situation with his father was a major impactful situation in his life, and he probably decided that he wanted to spend as much time with his father as he could before he passed away. He realized that his dad, only all of us only have so much time. And you reach a certain level and you think, okay, what's really important to me at this time? Is it my relationship with my dad? Is it seeing my dad as much as I can? Or is it working at Apple? That was one of the things about Steve Jobs that truly shocked me. Even when he was clearly sick and dying, and we all knew that he was dying, he was still at Apple, working at Apple, focused on like the next product.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think to myself, that is wild. I don't understand that. If I knew that I was dying, I'd be done. I would leave Apple. I would never step another foot in. I would say, I'm spending 100% of my time with my family and my kids, and I'm going to enjoy my children as much as possible before I go. I mean, who cares about your company? Are you crazy? Like, it's just a company.
Well, I think he was working a lot from home, and I think he got to spend a lot of time with his family as well as, you know, at the company. But I understand exactly what you're saying. Yeah, you know, because, you know,
he was a machine.
Yeah, he'd been so closely tied to Apple for so long, you know, it was his, so central to his identity and to what he did. I mean, he was like that. He was a fanatical, you know, workaholic anyway. I think Ive is too. You know, it's cut from the same cloth.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But he's very close to his dad. You know, like his dad was a design inspector, was a design teacher and a silversmith, and worked very closely to create a design curriculum for UK schools. And knew a lot of people in the design world, and like, you know, encourages Johnny's, you know, in talent and interest in design. And they worked on a lot of projects together. Like they restored a car together, and he would take him to his to these studios like as a special treat once a year to let him work in these big industrial design studios. And they've been very, very close. I think I saw a report somewhere they spoke every day.
Wow. So he's very close to his father. Mm. His father's ailing.
Yeah.
See, that's a big part of this story.
Right. I think
that could
so.
Be a, that could be a majority of the story right there. Your dad's dying and you love your dad. You just want to see him.
Yeah. And it's difficult, you know, obviously being on different parts of the world.
Right.
So.
Right. And then you have that guilt factor involved. It's like my father's, you know, passing or slowly dying. And here I am working. I mean, there's a lot involved. Anyway, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but this was definitely an interesting story that a lot of us were looking at and thinking about and talking about this week. And it's definitely something to keep an eye out on. We talked about this. I think we wrapped up with this last week, just saying, I guess we'll see what happens with the new class of designers at Apple. We have yet to see what they're capable of and what they're going to be able to do. And maybe this new blood will be a good thing for Apple. But as you mentioned, I hope the culture is fully ingrained. I hope it's etched in stone so that they don't start treating designers like the designers at Samsung are probably treated, you know, where they are asked to put a new skin on a laptop that a marketing guy came up with and had an engineer create based on a market research survey.
Well, you know, if you look at Samsung, but if you look at Samsung's hardware, you know, I don't think they necessarily have a problem with that. You know, I mean, apart from this folding phone, you know, that I think that seems like a marketing decision gone bad. But you know, most of Samsung's hardware is really, really nice. It's really, really beautiful. The latest Galaxy phones are like, you know, they're as good as anything coming out of Apple, I think.
Oh, come on now.
The hardware is, yeah.
The hardware, I don't know, maybe. I certainly think that Samsung makes beautiful products and beautiful phones, for sure. But I often see them include features that are obviously gimmicks just to sell the phone. And I don't think they're as premium as an Apple phone is, especially when you look at the OS and the hardware working together.
Right, but you see, that's not just the hard. You know what I mean? I was just talking about just like the purely the hardware.
Just the pure hardware.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't touch a Galaxy phone with a pooey stick, because like you said, it really is horrible. And they definitely were really bad with all the features. Remember, was it the 8 or something like that? The one that had all these kind of crazy.
The Note. Yeah.
It had a whole bunch of different stuff they were doing, but. That, you know, I think that their expertise in making in hardware is extraordinary. It's really good.
All I'm saying is, if you came up to me with a Samsung phone in one hand and a piece of newspaper that a bum had just used to wipe his arse in the other hand, and you asked me which one I wanted to put to my face and talk on, I wouldn't choose the newspaper, but I'd have to think about it for a second.
Yeah, right.
That's what I'm saying. Okay, well, let's talk about Tim Cook's response to this Wall Street Journal story, because he was furious. He was so mad that he almost showed it. He wrote an email, a very polite email to the, I think to the person who wrote this story, didn't he?
Well, no, he wrote to an NBC reporter complaining about the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
So, but then we haven't revealed what the Wall Street Journal, you know, what he said to them directly.
Okay. So he wrote an email to this journalist at NBC, did you say?
I think it was, yeah, NBC.
It's probably someone asking him to comment.
Right.
Okay, well, that might explain why he was so polite. He said, "Hey, y'all, hope you're well." And then he went on to say, "This story is absurd. A lot of the reporting and certainly the conclusions just don't match reality." Ooh, baby, got him, Tim. "At a base level, it shows a lack of understanding about how the design team works and how Apple works. It distorts relationships, decisions, and events to the point that we just don't recognize the company, y'all. It claims to describe the design team." I read that wrong. "That we don't recognize the company it claims to describe. The design team is phenomenally talented. As Johnny Ive has said, they're stronger than ever. And I have complete confidence that they will thrive under Jeff, Evans, and Allen's leadership. We know the truth, and we know the incredible things that they're capable of doing. The projects they're working on will blow you away, y'all." Best, Tim Cook. My favorite part about this entire thing is he sent this entire email from his iPhone, which I think is hilarious. The fact that he responded to this story via email on his iPhone, but he didn't make a single typo. Did you see this email? It's perfect. Grammatically
perfect. Is that what
made
you suspicious about it?
Yeah. Who sends an email that's this perfectly worded from their iPhone?
Well,
nobody.
There's an apostrophe missing.
There is?
Yeah. And Jeff Evans and Alan's leadership.
Oh, come on. That's nitpicking. He doesn't have to have
a typo. And there's one.
No, that's not. He doesn't need an apostrophe there. Oh, Jeff. Oh, you're okay. Let's take that back. Jeff Evans and Allen's leadership.
Jeff's Evans
apostrophe.
Yeah, and
right?
Allen's leadership.
Yep. Okay.
I guess.
Touche.
Anyway.
Touche. That's why you're making the big bucks sitting in Cult of Mac World headquarters, and I'm just here in this lonely cult cast
shed
studio.
Okay.
Yeah. Shed.
Cult shed.
Yeah. So Tim Cook obviously not happy about this story, but he also didn't say anything specifically about it was wrong.
Well, that's what that...
He just said the whole thing was patently absurd.
Right, that's what everyone's complaining about. It's like, you know, why didn't he engage and with the actual details of the story and say what exactly was wrong? But, you know, like we said, he was writing to this NBC reporter, not the reporter of the story, so who knows, you know, like, I think they were asked to comment. They probably didn't on the Wall Street Journal story.
Yeah.
Because it would have been included. Yeah, I don't know what he said to the Wall Street Journal reporter. This reminds me of, you remember when Yukari Kane's book came out, Haunted Empire?
Yeah.
So, and she was a Wall Street Journal reporter. She actually had a bunch of scoops, you know, about Apple in the run-up to this. And she wrote this book, and it was about how, you know, Apple was doomed without Steve Jobs. Cook attacked that when the book came out. And I think he said he used almost the same phrasing. You know, we don't recognize the company that's being described here. And I think a few other executives as well commented on it. I seem to remember. I think Phil Schiller said something about it. But, yeah, they weren't happy with that book at all.
But of course, that's what they're going to say. And they're not going to add any credibility to any of the story because it's going to make them and Apple look bad. And maybe Tim Cook has a different interpretation of what is happening at Apple than Johnny Ive does. That's also entirely possible. Right. So, I mean, what do you expect him to say? This is about as much of a statement as he can make. And plus, they don't want to add any credibility to the story by going into detail. So if I were Tim, I would just send a two-sentence email as well and just leave it alone and let the story die is what I would do. They need Katie Cotton back, though. They need someone
right,
to
yeah.
damage
control. She would have dealt with that, yeah, for sure. She would have dealt
with
that.
No one would dare write this kind of story about Apple under her watch. She would destroy you in your entire life.
I don't know whether, you know, like... I got an email from Johnny Ive himself, but it didn't say anything, you know, unfortunately. I just said, congratulations, you know, an amazing career, and I wish you the best. And, you know, the reply came back, well, thanks.
That's it?
That was it.
And he said, who's this again?
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, remember you gave me my bag that one time? He's like, I was fixing to take that bag home.
I know. I was hoping he was going to like there would be like a 10 pages of outpouring of all the details, but
yeah, all the juicy tidbits.
Unfortunately, not. And I wrote to Clive Grinier as well, like his old colleague from his UK days, trying to get an explanation from him. And Clive said a couple of things, but I mean, nothing really sort of revelatory.
Oh.
Mostly about his legacy, you know, which is like assured. I think there's no doubt about that. So it'll be interesting to see what emerges in the like coming weeks or months, if there is any more to the story, or if he comments on it. I think we mentioned this last week too. I wonder whether he can be frank about what happened. Probably not, but
I don't think so. It will die with him, I think.
Someone said that what was it? One of the quotes in one of the stories was like, "There's two ways to leave Apple. One of them is like you make the press and that's bad." And the other one is like you just quietly leave and no one notices and that's good and you never speak about it ever again. But one of the things I found with people, especially from the designers of the iPhone, they're pretty keen to tell their story. I think it's they see that they've had this they created this like this once in a generation product that really has changed the world, and they're kind of they don't want to be. Like, Steve Jobs would never let these guys talk, and he didn't want anyone to know who they were or what their story was. But the story behind it, is of course, is fascinating. And I think, they sort of create some recognition. So I think Johnny Ive is like that, too. His first stab at it was that book, the design book, the monograph, how would you call it? But it was all
the
pictures.
Monogram? Uh-huh.
And it didn't really explain what you were looking at, and which I thought was like a big missed opportunity because, you need to sort of spell it out and explain to people what, what they were doing.
You mean the book with all the different products in it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. It was just these blank white images. Yeah, right. That show you. I think the idea was the pictures were supposed to communicate the state of ideas throughout the product creation. And he didn't want to clutter it with words. It's just, let's show them pure imagery.
Right. And I don't know how much they want to talk about like the problems they had and all the different, because when I was in the book, every single one of the designs, has there's problems, there's compromises, there's headaches, there's things they had to figure out how to solve, which I think is the most interesting part. But, I don't know if they, I haven't seen any of that come out. Like every time they do an official story about a product's genesis, it's always very positive. They never talk about the problems that they encountered and like how the problems shaped the products that they designed. But of course, the problems are like a huge part of the process, and in fact, probably the most important part, because the good design, comes out of constraints and problems overcome.
Maybe talking about the problems would reveal too much of the process,
right?
And they don't want to reveal the process. I would venture to guess that one of the designers would write a book eventually about their experience at Apple and cash in on that and take all the accolades and glory of their contributions, right?
Yeah.
But they have got to be locked down with so many NDAs, probably lifelong NDAs that don't allow them to actually speak about their experience there and what it was really like working with Tim Cook.
Right. I think that's very definitely true, and they definitely do that. But, Ken Kosciender wrote a really good book about his experience working in the human interface group, the people who came up with the software for the iPhone. And he revealed, I thought it was pretty... Frank book. I don't know what he took out or what he was persuaded to take out, if anything. But yeah. It seemed, I thought it was very insightful and very, very insidery. Have you not read it?
No, I didn't read it.
It's great. It's a really, really good book. It's one of the, you know, like it's a great, great insider's account. Really, really easy to read. Really, really fascinating and interesting. Talking about it.
What did you say it was called again?
Creative Selection.
Creative Selection. I think I remember you talking about this. Yeah. Maybe even on a previous show.
I interviewed him and did a podcast on it, and we wrote a couple of stories about it. It's one of the few books. I think it. Maybe unique. I'm not really sure if there is another book like it about an insider at Apple who talks about the whole process, the internal process.
Yeah, right. Fascinating.
I mean, that stuff has been reported before, but I don't think an insider has actually written their own book about it.
Right.
Yeah, highly recommend it. I think it's a really great book.
Okay. Let's wrap up with this story. This was was this an excerpt from your book or just promoting your excellent book, your excellent Johnny Ive, The Genius Behind Apple's Greatest Products book, available on Amazon and at book retailers near you. And the story is why Apple will miss Johnny Ive's fabulous fiddle factor. I just like saying fiddle factor. I'll link to this in the show notes. This really was a great story, Leander. I wish you would have made it longer because it was actually kind of short. I was getting down toward the bottom now, and I was like, oh. I actually have the book, but I haven't read it.
Propping up a door somewhere.
Maybe you could sign one for me and send it my way.
Okay, sure, you're on.
And then I can read it and say, ah, look at that fresh signature. I wonder how much this would be worth on eBay. I mean, I would never sell this. I would never sell this in 100 years. Tell me about the fiddle factor and Johnny Ive's first, well, I guess it was one of his first creations, that pen was, wasn't it?
Right, yeah. So the fiddle factor, you know, I think cuts to the heart of Johnny Ive's design genius. You know, in his 30-year career, he's, you know, no one has been as successful as he has at making computers friendly and approachable. And it has everything to do with adding tactile elements to his designs. And this started back when he was a design student in the 1980s. You know, he was he spent a semester at a design agency in London called the Robert Weavers Group. And one of his projects was to design a new pen for Japan Zebra Co. Limited, a pen maker based in Tokyo. And the pen had was a nice-looking pen. It was in white plastic, of course, right? So this is like one of his first products that made in white, which would become his signature. But it had this weird ball mechanism at the top that you could fiddle with. You know, and people became really addicted to fiddling with this ball on the end of the pen. And it came from this observation that he made that people like to fiddle with their pens. So he made it expressly, you know, fiddle worthy, and he called it the fiddle factor. And the head of the firm, you know, loved this so much that the company loved it. The Japanese company loves it so much that they put the pen into production, which is like super rare for like a teenage design student. You know what? That never happens. And they sold it for many years, but it was that, you know, like, and this is one of the insights I had sort of writing the book about him, was that when he got to Apple. The iMac, you know, the first iMac, the Bondi Blue iMac, he added a handle to it. And ostensibly the handle was for, you know, so you could pick it up and move it around. But, you know, no one ever did that. No one ever really, you know, it was really what he did was that he was looking at the computer and he thought, you know, computers are intimidating. They're unfriendly. But if you put a handle on it, it invites someone to touch it. And by touching it, you make it friendly and approachable. And he did this with most of his subsequent computers, like almost all the Power Macs, you know, the G3, the G4, the G5, they all have handles. Even the new Mac Pro has handles on it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his most successful products were things like the iPod, you know, which is like a precursor with a scroll wheel. You touch it, right? Obviously. And it's a precursor of the iPhone. The iPhone, it's like, you touch it, you use it with your fingers. This has been a theme, you know, tactility, touching, holding something, you know, interacting with your hands. You know, it's so human. It's so, and it makes the technology more approachable, more friendly, less intimidating. And this is a line that's run throughout his whole career.
I wonder if these kinds of touches are what give Apple that indistinguishable lust factor that we've talked about before. You know, that feeling you get when you use an Apple product where you feel like you're actually in love with it. Like it is a girlfriend or something. I wonder if he is primarily the one who's responsible for creating that sensation that you have about those Apple products, that so many other products in the vast swath of technology, you just don't get that feeling from. It might feel like a good tool and you're like, I enjoy using this, but you don't have that, you don't have that implicit love for your technology. And I wonder if it's the little touches that Johnny Ive is that he put on those different Apple technology products.
He definitely
had
it.
Give you that loving feeling. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I think it existed before. You know, it goes back to the first Mac. You know, the first Macintosh, and like all the different little whimsical touches there, especially in the software. Mm-hmm. You know, all those things. My experience. You know, I remember the beauty of, you know, using Apple's products was, one, is it totally intuitive. You just pick it up and you can use it. You know, I remember picking up the iPod for the first time and fiddling with the wheel. You know, you don't have to read a manual about that. You could just pick it up and you'd start playing around with it, and within a couple of minutes you figured out how to use it. Same with the iPhone, same with the Macintosh. You know, back in the early days, you know, we had a computer lab where they had all these horrible Windows machines, you know, DOS prompts, and it had C prompts and BASIC, and you had to learn a programming language to get it to do anything. And then along comes the Mac, and you got a mouse, and you can see, oh, you know, it moves the cursor around on the screen. You start clicking on things. Totally intuitive, totally, you know, obvious, and immediately you can figure out, you know, how to use, you know, most of it anyway, or a lot of it. You could get by, and there's all those little whimsical touches too, like, you know, the move cow and all these little Easter eggs, and you know, just this sort of, you discover something and it would delight you because someone had thought of that.
Yeah,
and I think he continued that in hardware, you know, afterwards. But I think that's always been a big part of Apple's DNA.
I remember one of the first interactions I had with a Mac where I had that sensation where I was surprised that they had thought of something that I was trying to do. I think I was trying to drag a image from my desktop onto a spot on one of their messaging applications. This is years and years ago, to replace my avatar. And it worked. I dropped it and dragged it, and it switched my avatar to this new image that I had on the desktop, and I was totally surprised. Right. And that was that moment where I realized somebody must have figured out that people were going to try this, and they made it work ahead of time. And those are the kind of little polishing touches they put on Apple products that really kind of makes you fall in love with them, that they don't have on so many other pieces of technology. Anyway, that makes me feel better. Good, I'm feeling good now because you're telling me, hey, Apple's been doing this for a long time. It existed throughout Johnny Ive's tenure. It'll probably be there after. No. The company's not doomed, Leander. It's going to go on. It's going to be better than ever. It's going to be Johnny Ive, the new class. In fact, they probably have some young, inexperienced but hugely talented British designer who is just waiting to take flight. And we're about to find out about him any day, don't you think?
Yeah, right. I'm totally excited to see what happens. You know, like if you've had someone there for 30 years, and I'm not saying...
Don't be ageist on Johnny Ive. He's still in his prime.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. And I was surprised because, you know, they were doing a car. You know, the Apple's definitely doing a car, and I thought, you know, a car would have been something that he would have been really into designing, because he's so obsessed with cars. I mean, he's been obsessed with cars since he was a teenager, that is the only thing that makes me really worried. You know, like because I would have thought, you know, if it was a total surprise to me. If someone said, you know, is Johnny Ive going to leave? I would have said, no, there's no way, because, you know, he's got the best design job in the world. He's got total freedom. He's working at a company with enormous resources, it's working on some amazing products. You know, why would you want to leave that? But that's the only thing that makes me worried. It's like, you know, like he's leaving the car project. That bums me out, because I thought it was going to be, you know, it's going to be some kind of fantastic blend of Aston Martin and Bentley and self-driving.
Maybe his contribution is done. It's like when an actor acts in a movie and then the movie doesn't come out for another 2 years. They're in post-production that whole time.
Yeah.
Maybe his contribution's already finished.
That's a good point. Maybe. But then, you know, what about version 2 and version 3, which is always going to, you know, the first generation of an Apple product, especially something, you know, completely new category, is it always gets better.
Yeah, definitely. I was just thinking back to the first version of the Apple Watch. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
How far has it come? Well, Leander, I think we should go ahead and wrap it up there, because I'm dying to light up some sparklers, eat about 100 hot dogs, shoot my friends with some Roman candles, and listen to... Oh, yeah! I'm feeling good. I'm going to take a ride on a tank down the street. I'm going to look at the bald eagles flying through the sky, and I'm just going to have my heart full of patriotism and full-on American glory. So let's go ahead and wrap it up there. That's all the cult cats we have for you guys this week. But if you want to come say hi or talk to us about any of the stories we mentioned on today's show, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Erfon, E-R-F-O-N. Leander is at L. Caney. This has been the CultCast, the best 30-plus minute album conversation you're going to hear all week long. New episodes of the CultCast come out every Thursday night. I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you guys next time. See that? That was the bald eagle flying over. Oh my gosh, they trained him to hold an American flag. It's so much patriotism, I can barely handle it. Is that the sound they make? It's probably close.
Oh, I thought it was a real bald eagle. Sorry, there's some drama outside.
Okay. some bum doing a turbo poo at 140 miles an hour.
Someone. I'm right next to the garage. Can you hear the garage door opening every now and again?
No, not really.
That's good because someone parked there. It's like super nice. Infiniti, is that what they are? Acura, yeah. Infiniti. Yeah, a really nice car. And right in front of the garage, and so people couldn't get out. And so, and I don't know, it's for some reason, parking in front of someone's garage in San Francisco is about the worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
You know, it's it just riles people up. So there was like, and it's in this office building, so and the manager got called, and then there was all these people couldn't get their cars out. So there was about, I don't know, 10, 12 people outside my window, all, and then the meter maid shows up, and she tickets the car, and she calls the tow truck in. And they're all talking, they're chatting, and it's like a fucking party out there. Then the tow truck shows up. It was really kind of festive.
Man, is it not taboo anywhere to park in front of someone's driveway like that? My blood pressure would go up 20 points immediately if I saw some guy park in front of my driveway or something. I'm like, yeah, what the hell? That's so anti-American. What are you doing?
Yeah.
That's a good way to get killed.
Right. I know, yeah. I guess he's lucky in San Francisco where he wouldn't get
shot. Any major city, really.
Yeah.
I don't even think you could pull that off in the country.
I don't know. It does upset people really. It makes people really, really crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, wouldn't you be mad if some guy parked his car in front of your driveway and you couldn't get out?
Well, yeah, people park in front of our driveway. You know, like every now and again, we've had people park in front of the driveway. And
yeah.
And we just, you know, we let it slide.
And you just say, oh, that's okay.
Huh? Yeah, I know. Because they feel too bad for it to tow it away.
Really?
They feel too bad for them, yeah, because, you know, they're going to come back, and then it's like, oh, yeah. My God, it's a huge pain.
What happened to my car? Well, you parked it in front of my driveway, so I had them take it to the tow lot and crush it into a big cube. Sorry. My kid was in there. Sorry.
Yeah.
My dogs. My dogs were in there. Oh, sorry.
That's the other thing. That drives people even crazy if you leave a dog in a car.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's anything people that will get your car broken into faster than that.
Right. They get the jaws of life and they like rip the roof off and then out comes a dog.
Your kid could be in there and people would be like, he'll come back. If they see your dog in there and his tongue's out, oh, my God. You're going to jail. Right.
I know, yeah. They're calling Petter and then the whole fucking animal control and yeah, exactly. I know, it's much worse, isn't it, if it's a dog.
Yeah,
worry about the kids.
Like
the kids are fine.